Okay, so we've talked about animal offerings and we talked about winged offerings, the birds, and then we went on to talk about flour. And these are called meal offerings, and there have been multiple forms of it. The third reading begins with yet another type of meal offering, the deep-fried version. And then the Torah begins to give us some general instructions. The final roundup is that, as a rule, all meal offerings should not be chametz, should not be leavened. And the Torah tells us that no sourdough or yeast or dvash or nectar, or sweet fruit or honey may be added in any way, shape, or form to the fire offerings of Hashem. There is, of course, a korban reshit, and that's a little bit different. And then the Torah turns its attention towards the preservatives that are added on a regular basis in the Beis HaMikdash. And this pasuk, this verse, which is chapter 2, verse 13, initially addresses the concept of meal offerings, but then goes far beyond that. Let's take a look inside. Pasuk Yud Gimel. V'chol korban minchoscha. And all offerings which are of meal. Really, mincha doesn't mean meal. Mincha means an offering. But as a rule, the word mincha tends to refer to meal offerings. So all of these meal offerings, the Torah says, bamelach timlach, must be salted. The Torah not only tells you it should be salted, the Torah then adds, v'lo tashbit melach bris elokecha. You shall not remove or seize the salt of the covenant of Hashem your God. Me'al min chasecha, from on top or from your meal offering. And then the Torah says, not only is it something which must never be removed from a meal offering, but furthermore, al kol korboncho takriv melech, on all of your offerings, salt must be brought. So we're going to talk about this business of getting salted. Why is it so important to be sure that your meal offerings have salt, that we never stop bringing salt, and in fact, that salt always be added to offerings, to korbanot? So the truth is that Rashi doesn't address the opening volley of the pasuk. Rashi doesn't talk about the fact that it says, v'chol korban minchoscha b'melech timlach. Rashi really starts talking about the concept of melech brit, the salt of the covenant. And the reason is simple. When we talk about korbanot, it's not the sum total of our logic, our rhyme, our reason. So you can't really ask a question. So why did God want salt? So why did he want grain? So why did he want a bird? Why this bird, not the other bird? Why this animal, not the other animal? What does he need blood for? None of this really makes sense to our minds. So Rashi doesn't say anything about that, but when the Torah says this is a covenant, that needs to be understood. However, I want to just tell you before we go any further that who places the salt is in and of itself a source of dispute. According to Nachmanides and Maimonides, when it says, "B'chol korban minchoscha b'melech timlach," b'melech timlach means you should salt it with salt. That's literally a translation. So when it says b'melech timlach, who is it referring to? So according to Nachmanides and Maimonides, this is a mitzvah on the bialim. This is a mitzvah on the owners, the ones who brings the korban, not on the kohanim. The Sefer Achinoch seems to disagree. He says, no. This refers to Zichrei Kohanim. This refers to the male kohanim who actually serve in the Beis HaMikdash. And he brings proof that there's a pasuk in Ezekiel in which it says, v'hishlichu ha-kohanim aleihem melech. The kohanim threw upon it salt. Now, I think Ramban and Rambam would tell you that was matter of fact, a narrative, what was happening, but not necessarily that it's a mitzvah. But at any rate, we have this very interesting dispute amongst the Rishonim, who exactly placed the salt. And we don't have resolution to this. One thing is clear, salt must always be placed. Now, if in the end the Pasuk says, "Al kol korboncha takrev melech," that all of your offerings must be salted, then why does it start off by saying, "V'chol korban minchoscha b'melech timlach"? Then why do we emphasize korban minchoscha, the offering which is of grain or of meal, of flour? After all, it's applicable for everything. So the Teiras Kohanim, which is the collection of teaching from our sages, verse by verse, and each verse, not the Gemara, which talks about the law or the rules of here's what we have to do, but rather the interpretive compilation of the teachings of our sages, also sometimes called the Safra. So it says two interesting things. Number one, the various offerings, the korbanot, are brought of animal life. So different, the two animal life that we have represented are animals, the cow, the sheep, and the goat. And so gesund, then after talking about cow, sheep, and goat, we have the second is the idea of the birds. Now, as we discussed yesterday, there are no fish. Okay, no fish. What about, so these are, that's the animal world. What about the vegetative world? Oh, we just talked about the vegetative world. We have the meal offering, which is flour, and that has olive oil mixed into it. So that represents grain and represents fruit, the derivative of fruit. No sweet nectar, but olive oil. Another thing that's called a korban is the wood that's brought up. In fact, it's called korban ha'etzim. So then the question becomes, do we have to salt the wood? Because every korban requires salt. And here, the Teres Kerim says, you would have thought that the wood requires salt as well, because we're adding now this dimension of the inanimate, the mineral world, which is salt, on the korbanot. So we know it has to be in the animal offerings. We know it has to be on the bird offerings. And now we're hearing it has to be on the meal offerings. So then the question would be, so if it has to be on the meal offerings, which means the vegetative dimension of offerings also requires preservatives or salt or minerals, maybe the wood requires salt too. So we said, no, korban min chascha. It only refers to korban min chascha, which is, if you will, edibles or a food-like, but not wood. And the Teres Kerim says further, we would have thought that the entirety of the meal offering requires to be salted, including the part which is eaten by the kohanim, for example. And so he says, no, it's korban min chascha. It's the part of the meal offering which is actually offered onto the mizbeach that requires salting, but not the entire meal offering. Which brings us now, okay, so the pasuk goes on to say, chol korban min chascha b'melech timlach, you get salted, make sure you... And then it says, "V'lo tashbit melach bris alokecha." Make sure you don't stop adding the salt. Me'al min chasecha, which is kind of like the same idea. It's not redundant. One's a positive, one's a negative. It's a positive mitzvah and a negative mitzvah. Here's what you must do: never stop doing this. And then the Torah here comes along what seems to be redundancy, and it says, "V'lo sashbit melach bris alokecha." Don't remove the covenant of your God. How did salt become God's covenant? What does that mean anyway? So here we're going to take a look and see what Rashi has to say. Bris, melech brit, salt of the covenant. Salt of the covenant. So Rashi says like this. Shehabrit krusa, that there is a covenant that's cut or guaranteed from God, lemelech, from salt, Meshesh Mebereshes, from the 6 days of creation. It means from the very beginning, from the genesis of creation, God made a deal with the salt. What was the deal he cut with the salt? He made them a guarantee. Why would God negotiate with the salt? Why was it important for God to give them a guarantee for anything? What was the issue? What's the backstory? What's the narrative here? So Rashi tells us, Shehuvtechu Hamayim Atachtonim Likorev Bamizbeach b'melach. The lower waters, which refers to the oceanic bodies, were very disappointed when God proverbially separated the upper waters from the lower waters. Now, exactly what this means, if you want to speak about it on a literal or quantum physics level, I'm not sure. But at any rate, that's what the Torah says. There were upper waters, there were lower waters. The upper waters or outer waters remain in the outer realm of the orbit or closer to God, whatever that means. And then the lower waters are here on Earth. And the lower waters on Earth have significant salt content. All oceanic bodies have salt content. And so these lower waters were disappointed. Now, not all waters have salt. That's true. So the salt ends up on the mizbeach, on the altar. And as far as fresh water is concerned, once a year, fresh water is brought as an offering or libation. And that is during the festival of Sukkot. Correct. Nisuch HaMayim B'chag. The Nisuch, the pouring of the water libation on the chag on the festival, which is generically, whenever we say festival, it refers to Sukkot. And all of this is to, so to speak, mollify the waters who are upset at their lot, at what happened to them. Now we'll talk about this a little bit more on this Bris Melech Hashem Alekecha. Let me add two interesting details and we'll come back to what Rashi says. Rabbeinu Bechaya, who we're going to quote soon, and he elaborates on this idea of the covenant as Rashi speaks about it, but he also says something else, which we will not talk about. He says that the globe can be divided into three parts. There is what we call desolate land or desert, uninhabited parts of the globe, which could include Antarctica, for example, or the North Pole. It doesn't mean it has to be hot. The desert doesn't mean hot or even sand. It just means uninhabitable parts of the globe. And there are enormous swaths of land where people can't live. And then there's what we call the yishuv, where people do live. And invariably, wherever people can live, they do live. Sometimes you ask yourself, why do we live in Canada? Why does anybody live in Canada? I don't know the answer to that question. The Medrash says wherever Adam Rishon walked, people will live. So I guess Adam Rishon spent some time in Canada. I wonder if he spent a winter here, but he did spend time here. And because he spent time here, so we're here. And people are adaptable. And everybody from the Eskimos in Nunavut or the Aboriginals who knew how to live really amongst frigid conditions, probably 11 months a year, to people who are living in the Amazon or living in the equatorial areas of Africa, they figured out how to live in extraordinary heat and with drought. And, you know, people get by. All kinds of people, every shade of people, every style of people, every anthropology, people figured out how to survive in all kinds of weather, with the exception of deserts. There are parts of this world which are simply uninhabitable. And then there's the ocean. And the ocean, of course, has lots of fish, but no people living there. So the Rabbeinu Bechaya says, here's what happened. The desert or desolate land, it was mollified when the Torah was given on it. So desert or desolate area, so well, there had to be a desolate place for the Torah to be given, so that it would be ownerless and free for all. That's what it represents. And then there's the settled area, settled land. Well, that had a base of Mikdash, presence of Hashem. And the oceans came along and said, okay, hey, what about us? We don't get no Torah, no Beis HaMikdash. God said, you'll go on the Mizbeach. And how do you go on the Mizbeach?
Salt.
In the form of the salt. So that's like Rabbeinu Bechaya, a little bit expanded, a little bit developed also. And another interesting thing is, the Paneach Raza, as another Rishon, he says when the Jewish people walked through the Reed Sea, which had salt content, so the Reed Sea, or its consciousness, complained before God and said, God never restrains the reward of any creature. And here we split open, where's our reward? And God responded to the salt water and said, you will be rewarded. You'll be on the Mizbeach. You'll be in the altar, you'll be of the offerings. Now, Rashi clearly does not follow that approach, because ultimately Rashi talks about the Brit. It's not a covenant. This seems to be like an ancient covenant, almost like from the very beginning. So therefore, Rashi follows the approach that the covenant goes back to the 6 days of creation. And as we said, Rabbeinu Bechaya will expand and develop this in a few moments. But the Sashbis Melech never stop having salt. Ramban points out that salt, by its nature, is a preservative. That's what salt does. And he says, therefore, salt never decays. Salt never rots. And salt preserves. Part of reality is preserved through salt. And he says the offerings, the korbanot, also are a preservation. They serve to preserve life. So that's why they're a natural fit. Offerings, korbanot, and salt, like French fries and ketchup. Rabbeinu Bechaya adds furthermore that it's not appropriate. You would never serve food at your table which is salt-free, which means taste-free. The salt, after all, brings forth a taste. He says, in the same way, you would never serve a meal. We never serve a fancier, beautiful meal without salt. He says, you can serve, bring it for Hashem without salt. There's this concept of hakriveu no lefecha secha. If you wouldn't eat it, don't try to offer it to God. And it has to always be kosher, and so on and so forth. Rambam Amir Nevuchim says something very interesting. He says that in the ancient world, the Jewish people were not the only ones to bring offerings. He says, but the major difference between the offerings was that the idolaters were very into blood. It was a big deal for them. And they wanted the offerings as bloody as possible, and they worshipped, it's called Mazel Maidim, or the astrology of blood. And so the salt, by its nature, draws blood out of the meat. It removes the blood. And he said, it's a cleanser. And he said, because salt is a cleanser, so we were basically demonstrating that we were not serving God in the way that others serve their deities or idols. This is similar to the notion that the Korban Tamid was always slaughtered on the other side of where the sun was. While the whole world is worshiping the sun, we ignored the sun, we worshiped Hashem. So this is a similar kind of thing. Abarbanel emphasizes that this is the great preservative. Mm-hmm. He says sometimes it would take time till the offering of brought on the Mizbeach, and no meat in the Beis HaMikdash should ever go bad, and salt was your guarantee. But at any rate, let's go back to our original concept. This is the idea of a Brit, of a covenant, and this covenant is something which goes back to the very beginning of creation. The verse finishes off, Akol Korbancha, on all of your offerings, there must be salt. Rashi says, Al Olat Behema, the ascent offering of the animal, the oaf and the bird, Ve'emure Kol Akadoshim Kulam, whatever parts of the animal that are burnt in the Mizbeach, always going to be salt that's placed. So let's delve a little more deeply. This will make things a little more salty for us. We're going to go to the Biyurim book, page Chavav, Simon Yud Zayin. This is the 17th entry here on Parshas Vayikra. And the Rebbe here quotes Rabbeinu Bechaya. Rabbeinu Bechaya develops this idea that Rashi just shared with us. He gives us a little bit more of the fuller narrative. So there's this bris, he says, Rabbeinu Bechaya tells us, there's this covenant from the 6 days of creation. That the lower waters were guaranteed or assured that they too would participate in serving Hashem. They'd be part of temple offerings. And here we have added in Rabbeinu Bechaya, V'chein omru b'medrash. This is what was said to us, taught to us in the Medrash. Mayim hatachtenim nikru mayim boichim. The lower waters, the waters of the oceanic bodies on earth, were called weeping waters. Why were they called weeping waters? When God proverbially divides the upper waters from the lower waters, these waters ended up proverbially, in the metaphor, on high, and the other waters ended up below. So we have this idea of weeping waters. The lower waters started wailing and weeping, and they said, hey, Amru, they said, Oy lanu, woe is to us, shalei zachinu la'alis l'mayla, that we couldn't be on high. Li yiskrevim li yitzeinu, to be closer to our Creator. Amr lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God pacifies and mollifies them. And he says, Hoylu l'chvoydi asisan, since you did this for my glory, because Hashem wants to create a world in which we should sense independence, a world that should not necessarily reflect the presence of the Creator, and since you did this for me, God says, you're my shliach, my agent, you're fulfilling a mission. Therefore, you will appear on the altar, in what form? Bamelech, in the salt form, where the water evaporates and the salt remains afterwards. Sea salt. That's basically an excerpt from Rabbeinu Bechaya. So the Rebbe set out to try to explain the deeper meaning. So what does that mean? Why is it important for our offerings to be accompanied by salt or get salted? What is the meaning of weeping waters? And how are those weeping waters somehow pacified by the salting of the offerings? So the Rebbe says like this, Tachlisam shel hakarbonis. Inasmuch as we have a difficult time wrapping our heads around the offerings, but what is the ultimate purpose? What, an offering is emblematic of what?
Closer.
Are drawing closer to God, correct. But how do we draw closer to God?
By following His commands.
Taking in the offering arena, by taking something material, something physical, by taking it out of circulation, we're makdish it, we're sanctify it, we bring it to the Beis HaMikdash, and then it's offered to Hashem. We're taking the physical, the ordinary, the mundane, we're bringing it up to Hashem as an offering. to bring it up to Hashem as an offering essentially means, it represents, it's if you will, it's emblematic of the general approach to lahalais ulereimim esadavar agashmi, to exalt and to elevate the material so that it should become ha'oilo lekarbon, which is brought up as an offering. Ulhavi'ai, to bring it into his achdus melekos, into a state of oneness with its creator. So the material ends up turning into a holy fire, which ascends heavenward. Again, proverbially speaking, God is not in the heavens more than the earth, but in the metaphor, we speak of God in the heavens, Avinu Shebashamayim, our Father in heaven, and so on and so forth. So this is the terminology we use. It's all metaphoric, not to be taken literally. Chas v'shalom, you're not getting closer to God if you fly in a plane or go on a rocket ship, but that's not the point. The point is, proverbially, that's what it represents. And the korban is this idea of taking something material, physical, ordinary, mundane, offering it onto a holy fire, and thusly it gets turned into energy. And it gets returned to sender, sent back to the creator. So the question that we could ask is, whence or from where does one get the inspiration, the courage, the ability to do something like this? And the answer is, every korban needs salt. What does the salt represent? Hakoyach lahalozu, the power of this form of elevation, ba mitziruf shomelach, it comes when you add salt. Somehow, when the offering gets salted, then it becomes able to be elevated. And why is that? What is it about the salt? Is it because it's a preservative? Why does that enable it to be elevated? On the contrary, we don't want to preserve the way it is here. We're trying to transform it because it's a cleanser. What does the salt have? It brings taste out? So what? What does taste have to do with an offering? And the answer, Rashi told us, and as shared from Rabbeinu Bechaya, is this is connected to Mayim Tachtonim, to lower waters. And Mayim Tachtonim represent what? Bechia, weeping and crying. Habechi, the crying, the weeping. Hachuka, the yearning of Mayim Tachtonim, of lower waters. What is their yearning? What do they desire? What do they seek? They seek Lahalei, Suliskar, Avila Kodesh Baruch Hu. They crave closeness. That's what they're looking for. Heim Hanoisnim Koyach B'Dover Agashmi. It's that yearning. It's that craving, that desire, that Rebbe says, that gives, that infuses strength and ability into the davar hagashmi, into the material, that it should be able to become elevated. Maila, maila, higher and yet higher, at kedei sachtos lalakus. And here the Rebbe gives us an example of a salty fellow. Dugma ledavar. You have a rasha. Okay, he's got a salty life. He's not living clean, not living pure. You want to bring him to tshuva. You want to help him return to Hashem. You want to help him leave his salty ways behind and become righteous. Who is most effective at that? Who will be able to bring about transformation better than anybody else? Huh? Practically speaking, you have a person who's misbehaving, doesn't follow a good path. Who will be most effective in turning that person around? Who do you think would be most effective? I will tell you, the person who himself has been down that path. The greatest addiction counselor is the former addict. That's the whole idea of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. The whole idea of Alcoholics Anonymous is to reach out to a fellow alcoholic, a fellow sufferer, and use this with all kinds of addiction today. And that, even if he's not a trained clinician, the very fact that he suffered from this and he understands and empathizes gives him the ability to help you to extricate yourself from that situation. To bring somebody to a Baal Tshuva, yes, tzedek b'hashpa asa shel adam, shehu Baal Tshuva atzmei. It's most effective when the person says, I know where you are. I understand your circumstances. I was there too. Me'acha sha'af hu ha'yirasha. He was also wicked. And he says, en la meroizeis, despite this fact, chaza b'tshuva, he did tshuva. V'chein bin yoneinu, my friends, the same thing is here. Because the lower waters experienced this distance from divinity. The imzais, and despite the fact that they were so distant and they were so far away, they didn't just throw in the towel and say, so far away. It's hopeless. But instead, they express this yearning and this desire to be close to Hashem. Yesh b'koichem lahavi es ha-korban agashmi. Then they can share that. It can infect, if you wish, in a positive way. It's infectious. They can pass that on to every material thing they come in contact with, that it too should be punctuated and flavored with the same desire, the same craving, and the same yearning. And that is the deeper reason why the offerings must get salted. And the lessons for us are many and varied. And the point is, we should always live with a sense of yearning, a sense of dissatisfaction with the ordinary, mundane, and material, a sense of yearning and craving for the loftier, the more spiritual, and the godly. And as long as we live life with that yearning, the Eibishter helps, we're able to experience korban, or closeness, in the most profound, in the most meaningful of ways.